Good morning, 7:42 here on the Mighty 690 as we go throughout a Tuesday, not Wednesday, good grief. It's a Wednesday. We always have folks from K-State here on Wednesday. And joining us once again, we have David Strauss. We have the Diversified Ag Natural Resources Agent. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing good. Thank you. How are you?
Doing well. Good to have you here. And I know for again, just repeating one more time for those folks who are just joining us again, 166 right there at the Deering cutoff. We're still cleaning up the remnants of an accident there. So just do avoid that if you're out and about here this morning. You can take that 1675 cutoff. That's just kind of to the south there. And you can avoid all of that. So anyway, yeah, hopefully everyone stays safe out there here this morning. But hey, David, as we go throughout, you know, the fall, and we seem to have some visitors back. I know you've been having some calls about a nuisance. Well, actually, I can't even remember what kind of animal they are.
Yeah, so they are considered a nuisance.
Yep.
And
are they mammals? Are they? I don't know what.
I'm not sure.
I actually don't know.
I think they are. But now I'm second guessing myself,
right?
On that.
Armadillos.
Yes, so we're talking about armadillos. So usually I actually get more questions about them in the spring and summer during warmer weather because they are rooting up people's lawns or their flower beds. And that's one of the biggest reasons that they're considered a nuisance is as they're looking for those bugs such as slugs and worms that they eat, they of course kind of destroy your landscaping around the yard. So in terms of, you know, other wildlife that can cause real damage to crops or gardens, armadillos don't fall into that category, but they are definitely considered a nuisance due to their tendencies to dig up people's lawns and their flower beds, and no one really wants them around, and they also aren't native to Kansas.
They're mammals, though. I did check.
Good deal. I remembered it right.
I feel like they should lay eggs, but they don't. You know, it's like a platypus sort of thing.
You kind of second guess it because of how they look.
They look kind of reptilian.
Yeah. So there are actually documented sightings of armadillos being first reported in Kansas all the way back in the 1940s. When they started to migrate northward from Texas and Mexico. But it was the 90s when armadillos became commonly seen around Kansas. And, of course, like we kind of just mentioned, they're pretty unique in their appearance. Their full name is the nine-banded armadillo, and they kind of have that armor-like plating on their body. So usually when you see them, they're moving pretty slow, just kind of meandering across your yard or across the road. They can move faster. Running is one of their only defenses. And then their other defense, which doesn't serve them that well when it comes to crossing the road, is their natural instinct, and they kind of use it as a defense, is to jump straight up. And they don't have the best sight. So when a car is coming, they kind of tend to jump. And that's one of the reasons why we commonly see them hit on the road or on the side of the road. So if you are having problems with them in your yard, the best way to remove them is to trap them using a live animal trap. And you're going to want to set that trap up in the location where you're seeing them causing the damage, the area that they routinely travel through. I have talked to some folks that have had really good luck just setting the trap up and catching the armadillo. Sometimes the armadillos are a little bit smarter than others, and you'll have to take chicken wire or some type of small woven wire and set up a funnel that goes towards the trap to gradually guide them towards the trap. You can bait the trap if you would like to, but that isn't always needed, especially if you're doing the funnel, because they do have bad eyesight, so they tend to like run along into that fence, and then they'll just kind of follow it into the trap.
Gotcha. And, you know, I've seen they also don't seem to be the smartest, because I've my dog loves to chase them, and so they'll go into the culverts and stuff, but then they'll just stick their head in, and like they're just, the rest of the body is still out of the culvert, so like they're just like standing there.
Yeah.
And sometimes they will go a little further in.
They think they're hidden, but they're not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you do trap an armadillo, it is illegal to relocate them to someone else's property. No one wants armadillos around, and so the recommendation is to humanely euthanize them. And if you live in town and you're not able to do that, you can contact me and I can give you a list of nuisance wildlife permit holders, and those are folks that are licensed through the state to take care of nuisance wildlife for other people. So usually you will have to pay them a small fee, but they can take care of armadillos, beavers, kind of any animals so that can fall into that nuisance category.
Well, that's really good to know. That's a good resource there.
Yeah, and so armadillos, I know one question I've gotten from folks before is if they hibernate during the winter time, and they actually don't hibernate during the winter time. But they do, just in general, become a little lot less active because of the cold weather. They tend to stay in their burrows. But you might see them a little bit more commonly, because when they do come out to look for food, it will be in the warmest parts of the day.
Yeah, I thought I saw somewhere that they sleep like 20 hours a day, especially like during the winter. They can just pretty much sleep all the time.
Yeah.
Now, are they kind of, you know, they seem to be migrating further north, and I mean that's the thing, is that sometimes I've seen them around, but then you don't see them for months and then they're kind of back. So I mean, it seems like they're on the move sometimes.
Yeah, they're definitely have been seen to be, like you mentioned, migrating farther north, and it's kind of up for debate whether that's caused by global warming, the warmer temperatures, they're able to move farther north, or if they've just gradually moved farther north, and as they move north, they're adapting to the colder temperatures. And one article I read said they actually, it's how hard or loose the soil is that also affects kind of their migration patterns, because they like that softer, looser soil because it makes it easier for them to dig their burrows.
But we need to, I still don't know how they managed to cross the Mississippi. That's still kind of a question.
Yeah, maybe they hitched a ride on a boat somehow, stowaway.
Wild. Interesting. So anything else that you want to share regarding armadillos here? I know, like, we kind of want to be careful with pets and things because of some of the diseases they can carry.
Yes. So armadillos are known to be a carrier of leprosy. So they're not such a common carrier that if you see one in your yard, you need to have concern over getting leprosy just from them passing through their yard. But of course, you don't want to pick them up, even pick up a dead one with your bare hands. Always make sure you wear gloves, you just shovel, some sort of precaution like that.
Gotcha. So probably not something we want to try to do a wild game sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't want to try that out in a stew or anything like that if you're wanting to get adventurous with trying out new wild game recipes.
Sure. No, that's probably not the best idea. So anything else that we should know about armadillos?
Not about armadillos, but we do have a couple programs that are coming up. So one that I mentioned before, which is if folks kind of want to take a little day trip, we're doing two small ruminant management internal parasite workshops, and they are November 3rd and 4th in Phillipsburg, Kansas, and Newton, Kansas. So if you do raise sheep or goats, these would be great workshops for you to attend to get some really good information as far as parasite management and just some general management. Dr. Hart, who was a goat specialist for many years at Langston University, is one of our guest speakers. And also Dr. Homer Gonzalez from Lincoln University in Missouri, that also has several years of experience with sheep and goat management, and specifically dealing with the challenges of internal parasites, will be our other guest speaker. And that workshop on November 3rd is, I believe, from about 5 to 8. And then the one on November 4th is from around about 10 to 3. And there is a registration fee, but a meal will be provided. And if you give me a call at the extension office, I can give you more information about those workshops and how to register for them. And then on November 14th in Girard, Wendy has a limit feeding and other winter wonders workshop for cattle coming up that evening. Dr. Jamie Lynn Farney will be the guest speaker at that workshop. It will be at the Civic Center in Girard, and dinner will be provided. And then the last one I wanted to mention is James has agronomy night coming up. That will be on December 12th in Independence, and he's still finalizing the details on that, but I believe he's going to do some sort of agronomy related trivia for that one, so it should be a good time.
Hey, that will be good. And David, while we have you here, I know you mentioned beavers earlier, and I just happened to see a thing in the news where, I guess it was in London, they're actually reintroducing beavers, which seems like a bad idea. Just around here, because people seem to always be trying to get rid of them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, usually around here, the phone calls I get is how to get rid of beavers that are causing problems in a creek that goes through someone's property, or their pond that is adjacent to a creek. I know most people that I talk to around here aren't really a fan of them.
Yeah. Well, and there was another thing that I saw. You have to look this up, but there was a video of someone had a pet beaver inside, but it sounded like a horrible idea. But it was making a dam with toys. Like, it actually dammed up a hallway with toys. That instinct is so strong that it just had to do something. So it just completely closed off a whole hallway. So
yeah,
this is wild.
Yeah, from a distance, I can see how they could be kind of cute. But when you deal with them damming up your creek or your pond, they can do some damage in a hurry.
Yeah, well, especially right now. And we would like things to be all, what water we have needs to kind of keep flowing.
Yes, so exactly.
That would be good. Well, David, thank you so much for coming on. If people have questions for you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, thanks for having me. If folks have questions, they can reach me by calling the Independence office. That number is 620-331-2690.
Okay, well, thank you so much, David. And I've been checking, keeping tabs on this accident again near Deering. Looks like, according to CanDrive, that we have that flowing quite a bit better than it was. So kind of would appear that that has been cleared out. So hopefully some smooth sailing there on 166 right around the Deering cutoff. So we have more to come. 54 degrees. Jesse Gilmore joins us next.
Placement is down. Butker's kick. Strong leg. And it is gone! Gone! Gone!
This Sunday, another division battle when the Chiefs welcome the LA Chargers to GEHA Field at Arrowhead. Pre-game starts at 2 on your home for Kansas City Chiefs football. The mighty 690 KGGF. Chiefs football is brought to you on KGGF by Roman Chevrolet, Rackhouse Billiards, Sawyer's Fine Wines and Spirits, Millie's Fine Furnishings, Merle Norman, Brewski's, Great Plains Federal Credit Union, Gemini Funding, Skyway Honda, Sports Zone Liquor, T.H. Rogers Lumber Company, Lavette Health, Anderson Plumbing LLC,
back here at 8:10 on the Mighty 690. We are now joined by Jesse Gilmore, who joins us on the phone. We have David Strant still in studio. So good morning, Jesse. How are you doing?
Good morning. Doing pretty good. Getting ready for the colder weather in my garden.
I know, you know, it's kind of a little bit bittersweet. You know, some folks, maybe they're done, they're ready for a break, but, you know, it is, it's that time of year where the growing season has pretty much come to an end, so we got to start thinking about other garden tasks.
Yeah, well, we had a very, very long growing season. Surprisingly, I was talking with people who were still getting tomatoes off of their plants last week, which is kind of unprecedented for the growing season for tomatoes. Usually they're done about 3 and 4 weeks ago. But there are some people who are doing fall gardening, and especially if you are interested in growing garlic, right about now is the time you should be planting garlic for next year. Gardening might not quite be done for some people, but for most people, the garden is winding down for the year. And so one of the things that you need to consider doing right about now before the temperatures get really cold and we start getting freezes is winterizing your garden tools. You want to make sure that your tools stay nice from year to year so that you don't have to spend the money replacing them or they don't become less effective at the things that they're supposed to do. A lot of times it boils down to hoses, mowers, and then other types of garden tools that are commonly in dirt. Hoses, you need to drain them. You definitely need to remove them from the spigot as we get closer to freezing temperatures because any water that remains in hoses during freezes, it will expand and can crack the hose. Sometimes it can cause problems with the faucet or the place where it connects to the house, essentially.
Yeah.
If water stays in that, I guess faucet is the right word for it. If water stays in that and it freezes, that can cause problems for next year if for some reason it cracks the connector area for the hose. And so when you're removing the garden hose, you're getting it out of the cold for the winter. You need to drain the water. That can be done with something like an air compressor. If you're winding it up in a coil around your arm, as you go, the water should drain out of the hose naturally. And it doesn't necessarily need to be completely dry. Like, you don't need to be a perfectionist when it comes to getting the water out of the hose. As long as you get most of it out of there, there should be enough air and open space for the rest of it to expand without cracking. You definitely want to bring it inside out of the sun. Ultraviolet light, even during the winter, people think the light gets less intense in the winter because the sun is so low in the sky. The light is just as intense and sometimes can be more intense in the winter depending on what it's reflecting off of. If there's a lot of snow that the light can reflect off of, that UV or ultraviolet light from the sun degrades rubber like is in hoses. So you definitely want to store hoses out of sunlight. Like if you're putting it in a garage, you want to make sure you don't put it near any windows. Most garages won't have windows, but some of them will. I know mine does. And that is really all you need to think about when it comes to protecting hoses for the winter. If people have irrigation systems, you absolutely need to blow those out. And that can be done by a lawn service. That can be done by you if you have an air compressor. But irrigation systems in particular can be pretty problematic because the lines for irrigation systems stay so close to the surface. They are also very susceptible to freezing. So I would definitely recommend getting your irrigation system blown out. Sometimes that will involve the opening of drains, and if you're not familiar with where those are, you would definitely need a lawn service to come and determine that. Because just like with hoses, irrigation lines can also break if there's enough water in there that freezes to where the water has to break through the line to escape and expand. And that can be a lot more costly of a repair than just replacing a garden hose. So definitely look into that if you have an irrigation system. For lawn mowers, most of your maintenance is actually going to be just making sure that it either does not have any gas in the tank over the winter, or that you put a stabilizer in the gas tank with the gasoline that is still in there. Because the longer gasoline is allowed to sit in a tank, the thicker and gummier it becomes, and the more likely you are of having a clog somewhere in the combustion engine. If you have an electric mower or a battery-powered mower, that's not something you need to worry about. You do want to make sure that the battery is removed from the mower over the winter. You don't want to store a battery out in cold temperatures because that will reduce the lifespan and the charging capabilities of that battery. If you have a combustion engine, the only other thing that you would need to do regarding the engine is potentially replace spark plugs if the spark plug lifespan has been depleted. If you have problems starting your mowers, it's either a carburetor issue or a spark plug issue. And the spark plug is much easier to test out first. For the blades of the mower, you do want to make sure that they are sharp. This is not something you necessarily need to do before the winter, but since you are doing maintenance on a mower at this point in time, it would usually be easiest to just do it all at once. Typically, the sharper the mower blade is, the healthier your lawn is going to be. There was one lawn or one area of turf grass that I was called out to an independent, and they were wondering why it had such a dull color to it. What we ended up determining for that one, is that the mower blade was basically injuring the turf grass, but it wasn't sharp enough to cut the top of the blade off of the grass, so you get partial injury to where the tip of the blade of grass was at least partially cut off from the rest of the blade, but it wasn't severed, and so you had the tip looking much more brown than the rest of the blade, which was still a healthy green. So sharpening your blades on your mower can help prevent that if you're having problems cutting through certain types of grass. You would just use a grinder essentially to sharpen the blades on the cutting edge. The blades are going to have one cutting edge and one non-cutting edge. Usually pretty easy to tell which is the cutting edge because it's going to be a lot thinner than the non-cutting edge. Usually you have to file it down to a point about 1/32nd of an inch thick in order to get the best cutting. So that is how you would winterize a mower to prolong its lifespan. The last thing you need to think about is any type of tool that has been digging or manipulating dirt. So things like hose, shovels, you want to make sure that they are clean before putting them away for the winter. That's going to involve cleaning off most of the dirt. If you leave dirt on tools, that does invite the possibility of rust. So you definitely want to clean them as much as you can. And then the next thing that you might consider doing, this is not a requirement, but it does help prevent rust over the winter, is putting a thin coating of oil on your digging tools. Well, the metal parts of your digging tools. You don't need to put oil on the wooden handles or whatever type of handle you've got. But the best type of oil to use for this kind of task is linseed oil. It's going to be very easy to find at hardware stores. You would just basically do a very thin coating on the metal parts that do the digging, and then you let that dry. And so that oil, oil and water, you hear that all the time. Oh, they're like oil and water. They don't mix. Oil and water do not mix, and oil will repel water from your tools. so you have a lower chance of them rusting over the winter. I said linseed oil because it is the easiest to find, but other types of oil would work as well. Linseed oil is the only type that I have ever used for this particular task, so I don't know specifically what other types of oil you should be looking for, but you should be able to find that information online if you are interested in doing that with your garden tools this winter.
Gotcha. So, Jesse, you know, as we, you know, go throughout the kind of the end of the growing season and that sort of thing, I know you had to leave out on our conversation last week when James Coover was talking a little bit about greenhouses. But I'm kind of curious for maybe the just the home gardener, that sort of thing. How common is it to maybe use a small greenhouse perhaps to extend that growing season a little bit, maybe if you have some plants that are in pots or something that you can easily move them into a greenhouse just to kind of keep them warm for a little bit longer or something like that?
Yeah, so we do have a lot of people moving plants inside for the winter, and that's going to typically need to be your more tropical plants or plants that you want to keep alive. When we say greenhouses in the horticulture industry, we mean actually a lot of different things, and not necessarily just greenhouses. There are obviously people in the district and in the area who have, like, poly or plastic greenhouses, but protected environment agriculture, or PEA, that can be more than just greenhouses. That can be things like high tunnels. That can be things like low tunnels if you're just protecting one particular row of plants. Sometimes protection for plants can be as simple as draping a blanket or tarp over them to prevent water from sitting on the leaves. It's pretty common. I would say that for most plants that I've dealt with are typically going to be in pots where they are not being taken into a greenhouse, but they are being taken inside. And especially with, like, vegetable gardening, garlic is very cold tolerant, so it's not something you would need to protect. But you do have the option of doing things like low tunnels if you want to. It's pretty easy DIY, actually. You just need some PVC pipe and some poly plastic to go over the PVC pipe to form like a little mini greenhouse over the plant. I would say if you are interested in protected environment agriculture, we do have specific publications on that. I have not seen a ton of people try that. Most of the time when I'm dealing with plants being moved somewhere, it's inside the house. One thing you do want to keep in mind about moving plants inside the house is you want to be very cognizant of what windows and heaters you are placing the plant next to. Just because they are being moved inside the house, that doesn't mean that there aren't cold spots or warm spots, especially near windows where they need light. Windows can be very drafty. So you want to make sure that you are not putting a particularly tender plant near windows on cold days. Most plants will be able to survive a little bit of indirect light or lack of direct light as long as they are getting the temperature that they need. You also want to be careful putting plants around heaters because sometimes the heat will overstimulate the plant. And especially when you have a heater near a window, you get a kind of whiplash between warm and cold temperatures, and that can be pretty problematic for more tender plants as well.
No, that makes sense. Now, for those folks who are maybe just trying to eke out a little bit at the end of the growing season here and who maybe have been covering those plants or are looking to cover those plants when we actually do have a frost here, is it, you know, some people just might use a sheet or something. Is there any recommendations on the actual cover that might be best for that?
Yes, but it really, really depends on where in your landscape that particular plant is. So if you're in a really cold spot that gets very wet, you want to avoid fabric, like fabric covers. So things like blankets, you would typically want a plastic tarp instead, because what happens sometimes, and I have not heard people asking me about this, and honestly, I haven't seen this either, but I have read stories about it from elsewhere. The fabric ends up collecting water, you know, kind of absorbing some of the water, and then basically holding that cold, potentially frozen water against the plant. So typically plastic is going to be better for that. Something like black plastic that can absorb extra heat from the sun, that would definitely be a better choice if your landscape ends up staying pretty wet. If you get frost more often than, you know, your neighbors or something like that. Microclimate can be pretty heterogeneous, or I think that's the word. Microclimate can differ from house to house, and even in a single landscape, you can have several microclimates. So figuring out where to put the plant for, to keep it as warm as possible during the winter, that would be on the south side of the house as the sun is getting lower in the sky as the earth tilts, as the northern hemisphere tilts away from the sun. The southern end of your house is going to get a lot more direct sunlight. You might also look into placing your plants in areas that get a lot of reflected light. So reflected light against windows, against brick houses, that light and that heat is going to bounce back away from the house, and it's going to benefit plants that need that little extra bit of heat.
Got it. Very good. Well, well, Jesse, we appreciate you bringing all that information here into us. And if you do have, if people have questions for you on this or any topics here, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, they can call my office at 620-724-8233. Or they can email me at jr637@ksu.edu.
All righty. Well, hey, thank you so much, Jesse. We do appreciate you coming on board. And look forward to talking again here real soon.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. Thanks so much. And, David, can we go over maybe just real quick some of the events that are going on for those folks who maybe just joined in on the program?
Yeah, we have a couple events coming up next month. So on November 3rd and 4th is a small ruminant internal parasite management workshop in Phillipsburg and Newton, Kansas. It will be the same workshop, just held at two different locations on those two different dates. If you have any questions or would like to register for that workshop, you can give me a call at the office, 620-331-2690. On November 14th, we will also have a limit feeding cattle workshop in Girard that evening at the Civic Center. Dr. Jamie Lynn Farney will be the guest speaker, and dinner will be provided. And then coming up in December, James will be holding the annual agronomy night, and it will include some agronomy trivia. So stay tuned for more information on that.
Okay, good stuff there, Dave, and thank you so much for coming on by. And look forward to chatting again here real soon.
Yep, thanks for having us.
Okay, and that is our update here from K-State Research and Extension. And we have more on the way, including an early bird edition of Open Line. Also, Candy Westbrook here in just moments.